Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Around 750 million people live on the European continent. So what about it? What will its future look like? Will there ever be a United States of Europe? For this and more, you will hear from European thought leaders, artists, civil society representatives, and all those who care about its future. You will receive key insights into the ways Europe is changing and how your voice can be part of this. I am Paolo De Stilo, and you're listening to Europe Matters. Tonight I'm joined by Gilberto Morisha, who is currently completing his master's in public administration with a focus on international European governance at the University of Leiden. He is based in The Hague, but he does many other things. He is currently a fellow at the German Marshall Fund and is also a global shaper of the World Economic Forum. But at the same time, he works for Colectivo, better known as C2, in Curaçao. And he's also a freelancer for social justice issues globally. Am I right?
Social justice, human rights, innovation, all the works, you know.
Man, you got an impressive CV for your age. You do a lot of stuff. And we were just before talking in the garden a little bit about all the various projects that you're currently involved in. And, well, where do we start?
Where is there to start? There's so many things to say.
Yeah, so I think we can start a little bit actually back in time. In 2014, you moved...
Way in the past.
You moved actually to Europe.
Yeah.
Because you're from...
I'm from Curaçao. It's a beautiful island in the Caribbean, next to Aruba, in front of Venezuela, just so you can get the idea. And I came here to start my studies, so I chose to do the study of bestuurskunde, or public administration, but in Dutch. And the reason why I chose my study is because I believe that you can create the conditions to allow people to change and become better through policymaking. So I was kind of baptized into this new magical European world.
And how was your first impression of this magical European world?
I mean, you know, I think when you move to another country, you try at least to prepare yourself. So the year before, I was like just reading like hundreds of books. I think it was like 100 books, literally 100 books. But also recognizing that, you know, there is going to be a lot of new things and that I need to have an open mind to be able to receive that. There's a lot of opportunity, right? Right. Europe is very much, especially in the Netherlands, everything is interconnected and you get places to places fast and there's always an opportunity everywhere. So that's definitely the first impression that I received from Europe.
Did you already know Dutch?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're from the colonies. What can I say? I said it, kids. But yeah, so... We went to school and one of the instruction languages is Dutch. So I did VWO, just like most Dutch people do. And that's why I went to the university here. I could just enter.
Did you feel kind of a bond with the Netherlands already? Yes.
I mean, a bond is a very, you know, it's obviously a very conflicting bond, right? There's a lot of good things and a lot of bad things. It's complex. It's historically loaded. So, you know, on the one hand, yes, you're Dutch. So that means you enjoy the pleasures of being a citizen of this country. And at the same time, you also notice a huge inequality between parts of the kingdom. You also notice the fact that within your country, there is still so much to be done. And often the richness and the wealth of this country is also a jarring experience in that sense.
You also feel it in your personal past, in your personal family past, that it has had an impact.
I mean, I think it has. I think this, there is always this very conflicting and you know, it's a love-hate relationship with the Netherlands as a country because of the semi-former colonial status of Curaçao or in the former Netherlands Antilles. There have often been political frustrations, and especially coming from a very politically engaged home, you know, like you hear that frustration often, you know, like, oh, this is happening again. Oh, there's a lot of things being imposed on us again. So that is also something that I grew up with within my mind. So it was also, I think when I was younger, I was very much, you know, this feeling was really there, right? Like this anti-colonial feeling. And then you have to learn to redirect it in a way that serves you, but also that is constructive and that is healing and that is transformative. So that was definitely a journey to get there. But I got there before I came to the Netherlands, so that's okay. Fine.
and was it easy to go to the Netherlands, or did you have to do paperwork?
Yeah, I mean, yes, because we don't have a BSN.
Okay.
So asking for anything that requires a digital identifier is almost impossible because you have to live in the Netherlands to get it.
Yeah, so for our listeners, a BSN is a burger service number, which is like your personal identifier,
yes,
of as a citizen within the Netherlands.
Yeah, it's like a social security number thingy. Even though we are citizens of the Netherlands, we don't have one, which means that we can only get one when we get here or we live here. So often the process of getting student financing, for example, is very difficult because you have to wait and wait and wait.
But at the same time, you didn't have to file in for a visa, right?
No. I mean, because we're citizens, right?
Yeah.
So it's there is freedom of movement. I mean, my passport technically is the same passport as the Dutch passport, except the only thing is we don't have a BSN in ours.
So you're a very far-reaching European.
Yes, which is interesting because we are European, but we're also not, in the sense that the islands are not part of the EU.
Oh, they're not part of the EU.
We're not part of the EU. We are EU citizens, but we are not part of the EU.
So you don't have any say in European Union decisions?
Well, we can vote for the EU elections if we register.
Okay.
It's because we're, how do you call it? They call it, there is a difference between overseas countries and territories, OCTs, no. And what's the word again? Oh my gosh. In Dutch, we call it ultra-perifere gebieden, UPG, and that stands for...
ultra-territorial.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's countries that, like, for example, all of France's ex-colonies yeah, are part of EU, but the UK and are the former
members
of the EU.
Yeah.
The UK and the Netherlands, all of the countries are not part of the EU. We're all overseas countries. And that means the financing is different. That means that certain laws are different. But it's also interesting because the Dutch kingdom, for example, I don't know if you know how the Dutch kingdom is situated. Oh, I'll give you all a breakdown. So the Dutch kingdom consists of four different countries. There is the Netherlands, there is Aruba, which is an island next to Curaçao. There is Sint Maarten, which is also another autonomous country in the kingdom. So there are four constituent countries in the kingdom of the Netherlands. Curaçao, Aruba, and Sint Maarten are not members of the EU. But there are also other islands in the Caribbean that are also Dutch. So next to Curaçao, Aruba, and Sint Maarten, there's also Bonaire, Ceiba, and Sint Eustatius, who are a special municipality of the Netherlands as the country. Like the constituent country of the Netherlands, they are a special municipality. However, even though they are a part of the Netherlands, they are not a part of the EU. They are also overseas countries and territories, just like Curacao, Aruba, and San Martin. It's a whole mess, kids. Trust me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you made it more. It's really complicated.
It's definitely complicated.
Yeah, so can I say maybe that also led you to do and study actually what you're currently studying?
Yes, for sure, because I think this political... So the political system is very, very present on Curacao. Politics connects it. Because we're a small community, politics connects to everything. And that plays a big role in how the country works. You know, roads, if they're not fixed, or, there's no more money for funding education or something like that. You know, that plays a role.
So the funding comes from the Netherlands?
No, it doesn't. So okay. So the constituents... So... Curacao, Aruba, and St. Martin are autonomous countries, right? So that means that they are responsible for their own budget and they basically run themselves, except for two, now three, key areas, which is foreign affairs, defense, and on-again, off-again finances, and sometimes justice. But officially, constitutionally speaking, two areas, so foreign affairs and defense, and every other country is responsible for their own thing. However, in practice, that is not always the truth because there is a gigantic size difference between the kingdom. So the way the kingdom works, right, is that there are two important level or multiple levels of governance, obviously. That is a big thing in public administration. It's all about the focus on multi-level governance. But there is the country government of all of the countries, so including the four ones, Curacao, Aruba, St. Martin, the Netherlands, and there is a kingdom government. And the kingdom government consists of one minister from Aruba, one minister from St. Martin, one minister from Curacao, and all of the Dutch ministers. So ultimately, the kingdom government is the highest power within the kingdom of the Netherlands. De facto, what that means just is that the Dutch government can basically decide what happens on Curacao, Aruba, and St. Martin if it falls under specific constitutional prerequisites. So there is this kingdom constitution called the Statute, which is the treaty and the constitution for all of the countries together and kind of governs it. But the biggest problem with that is there is no control mechanism because there is no kingdom parliament.
Yeah.
So it's a whole complex mess.
Yeah. So there we could say old powers are still matter. They still matter.
Oh, sure, definitely.
So old systems, old ways of governing, of functioning.
Often colonial, yes.
Often colonial, because that also, I think... we want to talk a little bit about that as well, in the sense of like how Europe also relates to the rest of the world, and especially with its colonial past.
Yeah.
And how also it is quite difficult because there's a part of us that says we want to be sorry. We want to go back and actually help again. But by trying to help, we do a lot of mess again, right?
Yeah.
So what is actually the best way to reestablish good connections with our the people that we've actually been suppressing to a certain extent?
I mean, that's a good question, because often, you know, it starts with how do I see the problem, how do I see myself. And often as individuals, but also as countries, we whitewash our history. I don't know, we're the heroes of this story, you know, and we don't recognize that within all of us there is the full complexity for good and for evil, you know, in that our past, all of our pasts are problematic. And with problematic, I mean that they are often tainted with injustice. They are often tainted with wrong choices that have caused harm and pathologization of, you know, bad behavior. You know, these things that they've made them their own. You know, they've created certain conditions that have become reality within people, you know. Often when we look at rich countries versus poor countries, the rich countries are countries in Europe and the settler colonial states. So Australia, the United States, New Zealand, and some countries in Asia, because of, you know, they also have lots of capitalism right there. And the poor countries are often the colonized. So South America, the Caribbean, Africa, and a lot of the islands in the Pacific are the ones that are mostly poor. And now we tend to turn things upside down, right? Because we're like, oh, they're so poor, so we need to help them. Why are they poor? You know, that's always a big question that we need to ask. Why is the economic system that we have right now the way it is? And why are the dynamics on a global level of power, of economic resources, of influence, of military might, so skewed to those who have the historical legacy of injustice, the historical legacy of, you know, this imposing colonialism, imposing imperialism on others?
Yeah, so does that go also a little bit in line with what Thomas Piketty advocates? No, he wrote in his book Capitalism and Ideology as well. He looks at how France relates with Haiti.
Oh, Lord, don't get me started about that. But I mean, there are still these colonial lines that exist, right? So the thing is, we want to, especially Europe and the EU, we want to live up to an image, but we're not willing to let go of the same things that are inherently the antithesis of the image that we want to create for ourselves. We can't be speaking about democracy and human rights and social justice and you know, like opportunity for all and solidarity, while at the same time, you know, France has never paid reparations back to Haiti. You know, and it's like, oh no, it's not going to help. Of course, what has happened is that the choices that you've created in the past continue to play within the future on an institutional level, on a social level. We call that path dependency and this idea of historical institutionalism, where the institutions that we see today, especially in poorer countries, where we call them often corrupt or, you know, backwards, uncivilized, very, very, very problematic language. But often what we see is a reflection of the choices that were imposed on them and continuous, because it is not just it wasn't just a one-time thing, right? People think, oh, slavery ended in, I'm here in the Netherlands, 1863, so everything was fine afterwards. That's a lie.
Yeah.
It's an illusion. So we can push it backwards, you know. I think Curaçao had like a big uprising in 1969, you know, to fight for equal pay for workers, especially all of the racial sentiments that were playing on you know, underground came up. That was like 40 years ago. 50 years. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, way more.
That's a long time.
Should we then on a European level actually have this kind of conversation of like rethinking
for sure.
And re-approaching also our old...
It is important. It is important because what you don't see, what you choose to not see will harm you. And what you choose to ignore will continue to drive your actions and to drive your behaviors and your thoughts. And then you were continuously asking the question or acting all surprised when, an example, when immigrants enter into Europe's space. Yeah. You know, we're like, oh, why is this happening? Surprise, Pikachu, boo. Surprise, surprise. And I'm like, it's not a surprise if you understand where you come from. To heal and to change, you need to recognize that you need to change. And again, it's not just about guilt, right? Because often I think we end up bogged down into this conversation about, oh, but I feel so bad because I'm guilty. It's not just about, I mean, it is about feelings, but it's also not just about your feelings in the sense of, oh my gosh, now I feel guilty and I feel bad about myself. You can process that. As a country, we can process that. As a nation, as a continent, as a union, we can process that if we're willing. And when we do so, we will be accelerated. When we do so, our growth will increase. But as long as we ignore it, it's going to continue to break down communication. And policy is not going to work. I mean, we see it in all these international crises, right? Like, when you recognize something, when you admit, oh, that was a thing, you can start moving on. I mean, Germany did it. I mean, they still have tons of far-right extremists and stuff like that. But collectively speaking, they decided we are going to admit wrongdoing and we are going to change. And economically speaking, they are doing amazing.
They have always done economically
I mean,
well.
I mean, not after the war.
No, not after,
not after the wars.
The wars, especially the first one, and that's what also brought them.
Yeah, exactly, to a certain extent.
So would be actions of like apologies already be a good start?
Yeah. Apologies are a great start. Funny enough, I was at a meeting. I think it was 2 weeks ago. So I was invited to also partake in the. So the Dutch government is planning. They're not planning an apology. I hope they are. Like, if y'all are hearing this, ooh, y'all
this
better go
big,
with that.
Big news.
But they are. They launched a committee to rethink about remembrance of slave trade. In 2023, they've declared that to be the year of remembrance.
Okay.
So they're organizing a lot of sessions and they're busy writing a policy actually right now. So they're advising, they're going to advise the Minister of Internal Affairs on how to give a bit of content to the year 2023. So I was also invited to have a meeting with other politicians and people that are in NGOs to speak really about what we feel is the option. And I think so there is something that is moving, but they have to be willing to follow through. If they are not willing to follow through, it's going to be for nothing. You know, and an apology is a recognition of harm and a recognition of co-responsibility towards, you know, like co-creation of a better solution.
Okay, so now we've been very much focused on the Netherlands, and its past. But do you think Europe as a whole should apologize?
The problem with Europe as a whole, right, is that it is a very fragmented union. And certain countries have not had that colonial past. And certain countries often are exploited by the ones who are often the colonizers. For example, Western Europe, so most of the countries in Western Europe and Southern Europe were the ones who went out and invaded other countries and gained a lot of wealth from that. Often countries in Eastern Europe were very much oppressed. So Europe should take responsibility. The question is, how do you frame it in a way that recognizes also the lesser responsibility for certain countries? And I mean, they all have their own issues, right? So there's a lot of racism and a lot of injustice happening there, but the context is entirely different.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And, yep.
You just said something. You said racism.
Yeah.
What's your take on racism in Europe?
I mean, racism was born here. Like, racism literally is a justification and an institutionalization of behaviors that created a distinction in racial supremacy, in this idea of skin color being connected to your identity.
For our listeners,
I'm black. Black is a great word. Black is the word we use. But yes, racism in Europe created racism as we see it today because of this transatlantic slavery. And if Europe never went to colonize the Americas, and also never used, because let me backtrack. I'll say slave labor has always existed. But racialized people and racialized slave labor as it existed in the transatlantic slave trade had never existed before because it was used as an economic tool.
Is that a fact?
Yes, it is a fact. Because what happened with racialization of black people is that it was used as a tool of creating a type of hierarchy in society in order to impose labor on a group of people for their whole life and for the generations and beyond. Often slavery that was in Africa or in Europe was often limited. The personhood of someone was never denied and never removed. Slavery in the transatlantic slave trade turned people into complete goods. So they were not considered human anymore. There was this complete dehumanization of black people. And they were treated and they became objects. They were like a bit more than animals, a bit way less than humans. So it was this complete removal of the humanity and the creation of race, because race as a concept never existed. You know, people's skin color always existed, but this idea that your skin color was inherently connected to your value and that your skin color was inherently connected to whether you are inferior or superior, whether you are smarter, whether you can do more things or you are able to be free or not, had never existed, at least not in the history that we know. And tribes like the Ashanti also had like slaves, but their slave labor was often because of a battle being lost, and then the people were kidnapped and they became slaves and they were enslaved and they had to build something for the people. And then, you know, 10, 15 years, they could buy themselves out free. And I mean, it was still brutal. It was brutal and it was inhumane.
It was really brutal.
It was. But the generational impact of it was limited because of the fact that there was freedom. It was traumatic, but the transatlantic slave trade, it created this gigantic level of generational trauma that continues to haunt the whole world up to this day, not just black people, but also white people.
So could we say that Europe is scared of migrants? Because of this?
But and that's a very powerful point you're making. And I'm not sure you realize, but because I am scared of what someone else will do, because in my mind, they will treat me as I have treated them.
Okay, that's very interesting.
I mean, it is because why do people expect migrants to come here and hurt people and steal money and kill people? Why is that expectation there? Where does it come from? You know, did they ever do that before? Who did it before? Oh, wait, we did it before. And so we expect people to treat us the same way they've treated others. And which is why we continuously cling to this, and as in Europe, to this repression of the other, because we feel if they come into a space, they will do
the same that they've done before.
Yeah.
And do you think, now it's provocative, are these thoughts well placed in the sense of like, do they have any base to be concerned of?
I mean, you know, the thing is with generational trauma, right, is when you create generational trauma, it comes back to bite you. And what we see in North Africa happening right now is literally their creation that is coming back. You know, the chickens have come home to roost, as I like to say, because, and I don't mean it in a, it's not great. It's not a good thing, but it is what happens when you continuously refuse to deal with the legacy and the historical injustices that you've created, and you push it off because, oh no, it's Africa and Africa is poor. And now suddenly North Africa is coming to you and you're like, oh my gosh, we need to stop this and we need to keep our borders safe. You know, and there is a responsibility that they do have to do it, because obviously you can't take everybody in. However, there's a big however, you know, this idea that these people are invaders is so wrong. You know, invaders don't come to your country begging for scraps.
And isn't that also the narrative that led Britain to leave the Europe?
That, oh, they're all coming to live. They're all coming to live here. And we don't want that. It's interesting, right? Because Great Britain, as you know, one of the biggest colonial power, I mean, almost in forever, right? And they're afraid of more people coming to them. It's the audacity for me. But, you know, and that connects again with this idea of white supremacy. And this is a link, right? Like, because whiteness isn't just about skin color, right? I think people think that race and racism is about skin color. Race is, it's a case system. That's why I like the term racialized people, because you having light skin color and me having a dark skin color means absolutely nothing. You know, it's a nice tint. However, the hierarchy that was imposed on people created this virus, this generational trauma that impacts the way people think, the way people see themselves, but also the economic opportunities for the people that were labeled as less. And black skin, dark skin, was seen as the least. And white skin, often, not always, often, was seen as human, was seen as honorable, was seen as was seen as great. You know, the closer you were to white skin, the better you were. Except race was not always just about color, right? It was also about politics. Race has always been about politics, because the Irish were not white. The Polish were not white. Italians were not considered white in the US. You know, there is this whiteness often is connected to privilege inherently. And not light-skinnedness, but whiteness is connected to this idea of I have the privilege and the honor to dominate and to control the world and the economic system and to dictate the terms towards others that are lesser. You know, and so when we look at the UK now again, right, dictating that and deciding that I get to do it with someone else, but somebody else does not get to do it with me, is literally the example of white supremacy. You know, and it's the mindset that we are superior and we deserve more. You are inferior, you deserve less.
This is a good pause for thought, actually. We're going to leave the listeners think a moment. Now you thought about it.
Next.
Okay, so you dropped a lot of bombs, very good ones, in the sense of trying to foster and rethink how we perceive ourselves and also how we perceive our neighbors, everybody surrounding us. And at the same time, you are very much involved, as I mentioned at the beginning, with two different projects. You're a fellow at the German Marshall Fund, which is a think tank, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And what do you think about there?
I mean, the German Marshall Fund was a think tank that was launched as a gift from Germany to the U.S. for the Marshall Plan. And basically, its focus is on transatlantic values and the transatlantic relationship. So basically, a lot of what we covered, and I'm a TILN fellow, and that stands for a transatlantic leader. So it's a lot about diversity and inclusion. But we basically, what I do is like we're connected with like all of these new leaders arising throughout Europe and the US, and we're trying to connect to each other and do projects on democracy, on human rights, on values, on justice, but also on climate, in order to create a stronger bond between the Atlantic.
And is it working?
You know, the thing is, right, on a grassroots level and on the level beneath, you know, the highest level, it often is working, because a lot of the people that do this are people that are self-reflective. They're people that think about policy. They're people that are knowledgeable and they are wise. Often at the top, that is not the case. And the reason it's not the case is because the top is often a reflection of the condition of the people within a country. It doesn't mean that they're bad or good, but the condition is also a reflection of, you know, what is happening in the world. You know, we see the destruction of the middle class. We see extreme economic inequality, climate change, dehumanization of people through multiple means, you know, through racism, but also through work. You know, that work can be so alienating, very Marxist of me, but yes, it can be very, that work can be alienating people, like, you know, factory work. So if you're never confronted with new ideas and never think about others and never reflect openly about your history, the people that you will get leading your country is the same type of people that you have become. And it's not that you don't have the potential to change. You do. Everyone does. However, when we have a culture that does not love education, that does not love learning, that thinks it's bad, that thinks it's...
With education, what kind of education are you talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, self-reflection. I love self-reflection. Self-reflection is key to almost all growth. If you are not self-reflective, if you cannot understand, and just look at yourself and admit when things are good within you, when you feel bad, or be okay and open to receiving feedback without it causing you shame. Look at all the dictators, right? They're often very, very insecure people. Insecure people, and as individuals, right? And when they are elected, you know, that insecurity that they have within them, you know, it often is systematized and institutionalized, and the whole system revolves around their insecurity. And we see it happening again, also in Europe, you know, and it's not that these people don't, you know, and that's the issue with democracy, right? Democracy is a force for great good, but also a force for great evil. Because if the people are not in the space that they need to be, or need to be is a very normative statement, but if they're not in a space that is constructive, if they're not in a space that is, you know, that they are at peace, and with peace, I do not mean pax, which is what we normally use as peace, which is about order and structure and hierarchy, but I often mean, I don't even remember the word, but
harmony?
Basic, what?
harmony.
Yeah, and justice, and that we are woven in together. I think in ancient Greek, the meaning for peace is to be woven into each other. You know, like a rug, you are weaved into each other. And we live in a culture, and not just in the Netherlands, but globally speaking, especially in the West, where we are the most disconnected we've ever been, while at the same time being extremely connected. You know, oh, internet is here. You can speak with everybody, but we're more selfish. We're more hyper-individualistic. Everybody has a burnout. You know, like everybody's depressed. And again, we're not blaming the individuals, but if something is happening once, you know, okay, that's an individual person. But if it's happening on such a large scale, we need to question ourselves, why the heck is it happening to us, all of us? So yeah, you got to be connected for you to be self-reflective and for you to elect good leaders. That's how you get a good democracy. Democracy functions when the system serves people, when there is justice. And yeah, you can never say there is a state of justice. It's always something that is being done. It's justice is something that we do.
I'm going to be, again, provocative. Is actually democracy the best way to go?
I mean, it's the best way is, I don't believe this in this idea of the best way. You know, it's a way. We're on this road already, you know. The thing is, every type of governance can be the best way if people that are doing it are self-reflective, they are just, they care about others, they are connected to themselves and to the community, they treat their strangers and neighbors kindly. Any system can work like that. The reason why we chose democracy, or at least why I feel democracy is helpful, I wouldn't say the best or even good, but helpful, is because it spreads the responsibility, you know, because you can, you know, it's a dictator is a hit or miss, right? It could be a great person, but it could also be like a horrifying person. And the impact of the power and the responsibility that they have is huge. Within a democratic system, you spread it out, especially multi-party democracies, you spread it out so much that the risk of only like getting like a toxic, insecure leader is minimized. And it is imperative on having an educated populace. Democracy is imperative to, you need to have people that are conscious and people that are politically involved and active and engaged. We live in a society that doesn't really value that. You know, so if we want to guarantee that democracy continues to work, we need to put in the work.
And that is also what you're writing right now. It's about good governance in your master's thesis.
Yeah, so I'm working on my master's thesis is focused on good governance on Curaçao and comparing it to the Netherlands and basically looking at cultural perspectives and in which measure cultural perspectives influence the concept and the idea of good governance on the island. Because often, like the Dutch Caribbean especially, they're accused of being corrupt and accused of not doing enough, not being enough, not working hard enough on their finances and stuff like that. And it often comes from the Netherlands. You know, the accusations come from members of parliament here or from the Secretary of State. And, you know, the problem with good governance, in my opinion, isn't that it's a bad thing. I think good governance is good, but it's such a container term for random things. It is often a very ill-defined terminology. I think most of the time we use the good governance concept of the World Bank, but it's often created based on certain metrics that very much value Western ideas of business, Western ideas of what is of nepotism and stuff like that. Are in Dutch they say vriendjespolitiek, like.
Friends politics, yeah.
I think cronyism, is it cronyism? It's one of the isms.
Nepotism.
No, but nepotism is family, right?
Yeah, that's also true.
Da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da. But you know, in a post-colonial state, right, or semi-colonial, post-colonial, island states, for example, you know, they're smaller. They're more vulnerable economically. They're more vulnerable politically because there are larger players out there that are able to influence. You know, what is an island government going to do with when a gang wants to, like a big mafia family wants to enter the country and use it as a platform for drugs, you know, and with all of the money and the influence and the power and the weapons that they have, they can do serious damage. How do you define good governance when the vulnerability is so huge? Food security, for example, the islands barely have their own food. You know, they barely harvest their own food because there's not enough space and it's dry, and because of a lot of historical and cultural reasons, because of slavery again, they don't have enough food. So they need to import everything. So COVID, boom, everything is closed. The economy stops moving. Money stops coming in and we don't produce anything for ourselves. So we're vulnerable.
And so just a week ago, actually less than a week ago, the G7 met up and they discussed the fact of setting a minimum corporate tax of 15% around the world, not to avoid tax havens. But certain islands, as you just mentioned, actually thrive or live on actually being a tax haven. So isn't that also this is very controversial what I'm saying, but isn't it actually taking away one of the ways that these islands can live on?
I mean, the Dutch took it from us already. Like, in fact, Curaçao used to have much more offshore companies. But I think in the early 2000s, the Netherlands was like, no, you're going to... Oh, it was in the 90s. You're going to have to stop doing that and do a lot of changes within your structures and your laws, and make it so that it's less lucrative and less able to be influenced by offshore companies. And so we did it. And the promise was that in return, you'd get more investment, etc. And IMF would help with funding and implementing it. So what happened, what's also very traumatic for the islands, is that they never followed through. So all of the things were done. They removed people. They changed the tax systems. And a lot of people had to leave because they lost jobs and the government lost revenue. And it never became a thing, you know. So they didn't follow through with their plans, and that also led to this big exporting of people, that people came to live in the Netherlands, which kind of created like this whole culture of Antilliana in the Netherlands. That's a whole thing. But to come back to your point about taxation, right? The big issue is that often these countries benefit from it because of the system that is already unjust, that exists, that penalizes them, and that has consistently stolen. Has stolen a lot of revenue and a lot of opportunity from them because of political maneuvering, particularly in the Caribbean.
So that also kind of shows where the power lies.
Oh yeah, definitely. Again, in theory, we're all equal countries and sovereignty matters, but power plays is the Monroe Doctrine, for the record, for all those who don't know, the Monroe Doctrine is a U.S. doctrine that was developed last century, a bit before, that basically says that all of South America and the Caribbean is the U.S.'s area of influence. But Europe also has that still with the ex-colonies, right? Because the U.S. is area of influence. But, you know, Curaçao is like a Dutch colony. So, a Dutch constituent country. But
to put it nicely.
Yes, to put it nicely. But, yeah, it's important to recognize that power dynamics play a huge role in why countries are still poor. Because often, I would look at Africa, right? Like, Africa is also so poor. But they are the richest continent when it comes to resources. How is that the case that they that they cannot develop their own resources, that their resources cannot be exported. You know, like, why?
Yeah, and I don't get me started, because otherwise we go wander off. No, there's like a lot of criticism towards China of investing in Africa and investing
also South America and the Caribbean
and in many other parts of the world, and actually employing their own Chinese workforce.
Yeah.
But now we're like pointing the finger towards China. But what are we as Europe actually doing in funding? And
it's the same.
Very little as either compared to the to China, no?
I mean, technically speaking, I don't know if you know that the ACP EU agreement that's going to be developed again. I think they finally finished negotiating.
Could you dismantle the
ACP stands for African Caribbean Pacific, and that stands for like so the EU has like a relationship with a group of like, I think it's 54 to 84 countries. And they create special funding mechanisms that all those countries can get money from and fund projects within their countries if they hold themselves to specific requirements. So there are funding mechanisms out there, and they're doing some things, right? They're doing some good things even. I think one of the big problems with the ACP EU agreement, but also a lot of EU's neighborhood funding mechanisms, is that the requirements are extremely high. The EU is very, very difficult with handing out money. Thank you, the Netherlands.
But also in Europe, it's very difficult to get the various projects or tenders.
It's so much steps. Everything you have to do, 10 pages, you know, like of documents that you have to send in, and the evaluations that you have to continuously send in every 3 months or stuff like that. You know, it's a lot of work and a lot of effort. And often people don't have the expertise to write those grants, don't have the expertise to write proposals or to apply for the positions or to put in all of the labor, because, and especially with NGOs, this is a big issue. There is no structural funding. If there's no structural funding for NGOs, who's going to do the writing? You know, if I'm not paid, I have to do this on my free time to get a project. And then often the
maybe even not winning it, right?
Yeah. Oh, the chance is huge. I mean, there's hundreds of organizations that apply for these things. So you'd spend 15 hours or 20 hours doing that and then not get it. You wouldn't get paid. You know, and this lack of structural funding for NGOs, at least, is a big reason why the EU's, you know, a lot of the impact that they create is often one-off. You know, it's like, oh, we did a cool project. And then it goes on for a few years and it stops because there is no continuity. There is no continuation of this, because these organizations are focused on survival for countries. The problem is often that they have extremely high requirements for democracy and good governance. And we come back to that. And again, and that's why I'm writing this research for the Dutch Caribbean, their good governance is very much connected to this idea of European values. And European values aren't always bad. They're not always good. You know, it can be good and it can be bad, but the framework that they use for good governance is not at all
applicable.
No, it doesn't connect. It doesn't connect with the cultural reality. You know, if your culture is very much focused on connectivity, right, on helping each other, you know, on a holistic level, right, then you are not going to. You know, you are not going to be as nitpicky about every single small thing as somebody else. And in Europe, we're very nitpicky about costs. We're very nitpicky about on time and on schedule. And oh, if it takes a bit longer, that's fine. Are certain things that they consider corruption that wouldn't be considered corruption in another country. For example, oh, my neighbor has a problem. Oh, don't worry, I'll help you. You know, that is considered corruption. But if your culture is focused on helping your neighbors and seeing that as something good, you know, you setting a requirement that that will not happen.
And that will be broken.
Yeah, it will be broken. And then the funding structure stops and then you don't get it. You know, it's this illusion that we can impose a cultural perspective that they do not have on them and still gain influence. It's like, you know, we're going to only kind of help you. You're going to fail and then we're going to blame you and then we're going to act as though you owe us something. It's a whole, and I'm like, again, there are a lot of good intentions. I don't want to say that people are not trying. They are. They're doing their best. There's good things happening, but we need to really reevaluate the criteria that we use. And when we reevaluate them, and when we connect with people on the ground, what do they need? How do they need it? What do they care about? What is important? You know, and in which way do they maneuver? Which way does the country work? But we want to, because that's where all of these things come together, right? Generational trauma also creates cultural values. Often, I like to say, your trauma is not your culture, but often traumatic experiences that are imposed on people through time and time and time again, you know, they are going to define partially at least how institutions function. And if these institutions, and especially when you look at colonialism, right? Often the people that were put to manage the colonies were horrible leaders, horrifyingly exploitative and corrupt people. And they were the ones who defined the political culture and the institutional culture of many countries, right? So this expectation that suddenly they have to fulfill these values that they've never known, right? Because it's the same values that Europe sent to them. You know, the values that Europe sent to others were very much exploitation, corruption, destruction, because that's what the colonizers had to do to be able to dominate. And that is the same behavior that is being perpetuated in the Caribbean and South America and in Africa. You know, so it is literally of our own making again, but we've civilized, you know, we're good now, right? So because we're good now, like we expect extreme high standards from them, but we've always exported the exploitation and exported the injustice. And now we're so surprised that people can't live up to the expectations that we have. Ding, ding, ding.
I cannot say anything further. Wow, Gilberto, this has been an amazing chat. Yeah, I want to thank you, Gilberto Mori. This was Gilberto Morishwa. Morishwa, how do you say it?
Morishwa.
Morishwa. Thank you very much for joining me here today. This has been my first podcast in face-to-face, actually. So this has been great to have you here in The Hague. And please, everybody, check him out. Check all the great work that he's doing with the various organizations he's working for. And because then maybe you can also apply to some of them and
change the world.
Exactly.
Ooh.
This is great. I love it. Thank you all and have a pleasant day, evening, whatever it is, wherever you are.
Thank you for having me.
Ciao, ciao.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of Europe Matters. Special thanks goes to my assistant producer, Antonio Mattesini. Let us know who we should interview next by writing a comment and sharing it with your friends on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn using the handle @EuropeMatters. Don't forget to leave a review on whichever podcast streaming platform you use. And if you really like this show, the best way to support us is by making a donation on patreon.com. You can learn more at www.europematters.com. Speak to you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.